This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
All right, welcome to Breathing Life into History. Just a brief introduction. I'm Lyndon Martin, and I taught 13 years. The last 11 years I was at Shade Mountain Mennonite School in Mount Pleasant Mills, Pennsylvania, Snyder County. I'm not planning to teach this fall, but it's my family, my wife Joy, and Heather and Shayna. And so history has always been a big part of my life. My parents had a set of encyclopedias, and the section, the volume for P was well worn because I spent so much time perusing the section on presidents. And so it has been a lifelong source of enjoyment for me, and I've tried to communicate that to my students. And recently I got one of the best compliments that a history teacher can get, and that is the fellow who taught before I taught at the school visited, and he said, "Wow, you've really turned their favorite subject." He said, "It used to always be science," or he said, "Now I see history." So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it, I think, reflects my enjoyment of history. So, seven signs of life. How would you tell if a mummy in the desert were dead or alive? Just spit these out. They aren't in any particular order or anything fancy. How would you know? All right. Say, has a heartbeat.
Responds to stimulus.
He responds to stimulus. Hey. Yep. Good. He's breathing. All right. So there are various things, and I don't have these in any particular order, but just some I thought of. He's moving. Something that doesn't move isn't alive, and that applies to history. He opens his eyes. He responds. He communicates. You can hold an interchange with him. Information goes both ways. He's breathing. He's bleeding. Wasn't sure about that one. So I guess it's possible for a body to bleed after it's dead, but not to the extent. My thought there was empathy. In other words, if we can get our students to empathize with the historical characters, if they see them bleeding and going through the same struggles that they have, it's going to go a long way in engaging them in history. Taking nutrition. And obviously you're not going to walk up to a man that's half alive and offer him a candy bar. He may not take you up on it, but long term, there's this taking in of nutrients. So the seven tactics of resuscitation that I have roughly cover these. And I'll let you piece it together. I don't have it correlated in the same order, but think about how can we get our students to see history as moving, as seeing, as being visual, as responding, communication, information going both ways, breathing, literally expanding, contracting, bleeding, going through the same things that we go through, and taking nutrition. In the dim temple in North Africa, the boy repeated the words, "I will hate Romans. I will have no other goal in my life but to punish the accursed Romans. I will reject appeasement, I will reject compromise, and I will win complete victory." Hannibal was only 9 when he clasped his father's hand and repeated those words after his father in that dim temple in Carthage. The First Punic War had been a humiliation for Carthage, and now Hamilcar, Hannibal's father, was plotting revenge on the Romans. And he wanted his 9-year-old boy to enter into that revenge with him. And he determined to invade not directly across the Mediterranean, but rather to go up the Iberian Peninsula, across the Alps, and come down the spine of the Italian boot. And that became the opening move in the Second Punic War. Now, Hamilcar was killed in battle as he executed that maneuver. And so Hannibal took over from Hamilcar in the operation at age 26. And he had quite a force. One place I read, 90,000 infantry, 12,000 horsemen, 37 elephants, and countless mules and accessories. Now, going over the Alps with a caravan like that was no small feat. And so you have stories of elephants losing their footing on the treacherous Alps, and you can let your imagination run as to what a runaway elephant looks like. They had to lure the elephants onto sod-covered rafts to take them across rivers. One story I read, the elephants went on a rampage and actually started trampling the Carthaginian army, and their handlers had to kill them by driving an iron wedge through their eye socket. So, after struggling over the Alps, Hannibal led his frostbitten survivors into the valley of the Tiber to attack Rome with the battle cry, "Conquer or die!" And for 16 years, he fought the Romans, got up close to Rome, besieged Rome, and finally, at one point, he was so frustrated with his inability to take Rome that he took a spear and hurled it against the door, the gate of the city, in frustration. But he didn't go home until his army was defeated and the Carthaginian Senate sued for peace with Rome. So he lived to carry out that vow that he had made in that temple at age 9. And then, amazingly, when he went home, he lived to pick up the pieces and help his beloved city rebuild at the end of the Second Punic War. Now, that's a story that in a textbook may be covered in 3 sentences. Hannibal of Carthage went across the Alps and attacked Rome and lost. And your students say, who cares, so what? And so I just give that to you as one example of a little bit of research, a little bit of reading outside the textbook that can make a huge difference in engaging your students. So the first tactic for resuscitation that I have is to tell stories. Did you ever think about that the Bible is largely stories? Stories are tremendous focus builders. The Bible is not so much names and dates as it is stories, because God knew that that would connect with us and teach us lessons. And so there are actually Bible characters that we do not know their names. And there's Bible chronology that is a question. And yet people over the world connect with the Bible stories and understand the will of God. Tell a story and the chattering and the restlessness fades. The eyes focus. The minds are engaged. The imagination is fired. And students are transported back to that threshold of time. And they start to hear things and see things, and their imagination connects with what you're trying to tell them. And so stories are captivating and promote concentration. They're entertaining and they fuel excitement. Become an expert storyteller. And this takes time, it takes practice. But think like the students. Learn the story and put it into your own words. Not rewrite it, but put it into words that the students are going to understand. Make sure that the clear central message comes out, and sharpen up the details. Make sure that you have a clear view of it in your own mind, and that you have things in chronological order. And one tip that I have found to be exceptionally helpful with telling stories is to make sure that characters have names, even if you don't know their names. Give them names or simplify them down to their primary characteristic, and then refer to them in that way through the story. The students will recognize Uncle Jumbo when he comes back into history class. Does anybody know who Uncle Jumbo was? Grover Cleveland. He was just this big happy-go-lucky guy. Utilize your voice and your facial expressions and your gestures. Use an object or a picture if you can. Someone suggested that you audition in front of the mirror. Somehow I never had the time or the emotional fortitude to stand in front of a mirror and watch myself try to tell stories. I'm more of an off-the-cuff guy. But immerse yourself in the story. And of course, those details have to come from someplace other than your textbook. And I'll just mention it now lest I forget. That paper that I gave you is a bucket list of books that are on my shelf that I go to. And the ones in bold are the ones that I go to repeatedly. There's some magazines on there that I subscribe to, and those are tremendous places to pick up stories that can help your history class. Immerse yourself in the story. Let humor come out. Don't force it out. Sometimes we think that every story has to be funny. Don't try to make it funny. Read storybooks of the era. That will help. I like to read Uncle Tom's Cabin to students, The Stout-Hearted Seven, about the Oregon Trail. I've even read novels to them that at least set the historic time feeling, like The Tale of Two Cities. The Tale of Two Cities is not historically accurate, but it is a good window into what was going on in the French Revolution. Simplify people to their outstanding characteristic. Think about how this is done in history. Can you think of anybody that is known simply by their outstanding characteristic? We always give them a last name based on a characteristic. I'll give you one, John the Baptist.
William the Conqueror.
William the Conqueror.
Honest Abe.
Honest Abe. Peter the Hermit, Ivan the Terrible, Charles Martel. Martel literally meant hammer. There's even an Anabaptist that has a handle based on an outstanding characteristic. George Blaurock literally means blue coat. So that's what we call looking for the ordinary and the extraordinary at the same time. If you can make those people stick, it'll go a long way into the overall concepts sticking. William Henry Harrison was the only U.S. president formally trained to be a doctor. And the poor guy died 30 days into his term of pneumonia because he refused to wear a top coat to his inauguration and proceeded to give a two-hour inaugural address in the rain. Ulysses S. Grant, the butcher of the Civil War, coincidentally could not stand the sight of blood. So if you can just find snippets of that type of information, those will stick. Use fun mnemonics. If a picture's worth 1,000 words, a mnemonic or a memory device is worth 1,000 reviews. I'll just give you one. Who's that?
Henry the Eighth.
And who is behind him? His six wives. If you want Henry VIII to stick in your students' minds, here's a mnemonic I picked up that'll help you remember Henry VIII. Sorry, but it's true. He married his first wife, she didn't give him an heir, so he divorced her. He married his second wife, she gave him a daughter instead of a son, so he accused her of adultery and had her beheaded. So wed, behead, repeat, and your students will remember that forever. Here's another one on Henry VIII that you can weave into daily conversation. As Henry VIII said to each of his six wives, I won't keep you long. So history is alive. History is the story of man's actions and his decisions and his family and his struggles and his influence. Students love mysteries. I didn't get that on there. Students love mysteries. What happened at Roanoke? Take some time to just talk about. What do you think happened to the lost colony? They love that. Get your students to read biographies. I don't want to take too much time here on stories, but I'll just give you a few other examples of stories that I found to really connect with students. Tell them the story of the first emperor. Chinese history. Who cares about Chinese history, right? Go read about Qin Shi Huangdi and the Terracotta Warriors and his search for the elixir of life and how his doctors gave him all kinds of things to try to make him live forever, most of which contained mercury, which drove him mad. At the same time he was searching for the elixir of life, he was building a huge tomb complex with a huge terracotta army with space left for him to come in the afterlife and bring that army to life to defend himself. He died while on a tour of the countryside, and they were so scared of what would happen if news leaked out that he had died that they hooked a cart of dead fish behind the royal carriage so that people would attribute the odor to the fish and not to the decaying emperor until they could get him back to the capital. There's a wealth in that story. Suddenly, Chinese look like regular people. Tell the story of the Battle of Marathon. You know why we have marathons? The Battle of Marathon, according to fairly credible legend, of course, was a watershed battle between the Greeks and the Persians. The end of the battle, Philippides ran 26 miles, 285 yards from Marathon to Athens with news that he gasped out, "We've won," and collapsed dead. And hence, the marathon is that distance that he ran. Tell the story of Nero. Go look it up. Nero, we recognize him for what? He, the first official persecution of Christians. It's the fellow who had the Apostle Paul beheaded. And so Nero is this tyrant in our consciousness. Go read the story of his end, when he fell out of favor and was condemned to die and slunk off to his villa in the country and hid out in a stable and was sniveling in the cow stable, quoting Greek and Latin to himself about how important he was, until the messenger came and said, "Well, they've sentenced you to be executed in the ancient style," which meant locking his head into forks and flogging him to death. And only then could sniveling Nero summon the courage to, with the assistance of his secretary, put a dagger in his own chest. And suddenly your students have a totally different impression of Nero, and they understand that those who take the sword will perish with the sword. Do a little research on relics when you study medieval history. Among the Roman Catholic Church's most highly venerated relics have been pieces of the true cross. So many of these were scattered throughout Europe and other parts of the world that John Calvin once said if all the pieces were gathered together, they would form a good-sized shipload. Yet the cross of Christ was carried by one individual. John Calvin also pointed out other inconsistencies with the relics. Several churches claim to have the crown of thorns. Others claim to have the water pots used by Jesus in the miracles at Cana. Some of the wine was to be found at Orleans. Concerning a piece of broiled fish which Peter supposedly offered to Jesus, Calvin said, "It must have been wondrously well salted, for it is kept for such a long series of ages." Do your students know the history of the little ditty, "Ring around the rosy pocket full of posy, ashes, ashes, we all fall down"? Well, it ties in to the Black Death. Ring around the rosy, the rosary beads. Pockets full of posies, so that you could smell something sweet other than the odor of decaying flesh. Ashes, ashes, burning the dead bodies, because it was too laborious to bury them all. We all fall down, dead. My students always loved when I would read them the account of Robert Fulton and the Clermont going up the Hudson for the first time. It made the rivermen laugh even more. Everyone knew the Hudson needed an oversized gaff rig and broad beam. They called his boat Fulton's Folly. "Never," wrote Fulton, "did a single encouraging remark, a bright hope of warm, good wish cross my path." So then fast forward to the first trip. The boat moved off again up the Hudson and kept going. Black smoke from the engine, then fired by coal rather than wood, trailed like a triumphant banner all the way up the river to nightfall. Next morning, the boat was still streaming steadily north. A plangent volcano, coughing smoke and sparks. One rustic reportedly rushed home, locked the doors, and shouted that the devil himself was going up the river in a blazing sawmill. Crews on other boats prostrated themselves and besought Providence to protect them from the approaches of the horrible monster. Tell them the story of the Battle of Midway. U.S. codebreakers had broken the Japanese naval code, and the Japanese didn't know it. They kept seeing references to plans to attack Point AF, and they were convinced that AF was Midway, so they set up this little trap, and they had Midway broadcast, "We're having trouble with our water processing plant, turning salt water into fresh water." And sure enough, back on the Japanese code came, "AF is having trouble with their water processing plant." And that enabled the U.S. fleet to be ready for them at Midway. Just little things, little stories like that. Takes 30 seconds to tell it, and the students love it. Do they know the story of the Japanese internment camps? Do they realize that the United States interned Japanese? But go beyond that. Go find the story of Senator Alan Simpson and Senator Inouye, I think, from Hawaii. Inouye had been an internee, Simpson had been a guard, and the two men reconciled, were friends, and promoted reconciliation for that horrible history. Do your students realize that 8 U.S. presidents are descendants of people who came over on the Mayflower? What would have happened had they turned around? I said about humor. Sometimes one group of students provides humorous stories for later groups of students. One year we were studying circuit riders, and one of my rather deadpan humor students, in a review, defined circuit preachers as preachers who preach in circles. I've met a few like that, but that became a standard story, little humorous story. Nobody forgot what a circuit rider was. Do they know the story of James Garfield? He was shot 2 months into his term. His assassin bought the .44 caliber British Bulldog because he thought it would look good in a museum someday. And after the president was shot, a man named Willard Bliss decided to probe the wound to see if he could find the bullet, and he got the probe out through the wall of the wound and opened up a whole new channel, which misled other doctors who probed for the bullet. One inserted unwashed fingers into the wound, which set off infection. Another one reached too far and punctured the liver. And what was a 3-inch wound turned into a 20-inch infected canal that 80 days later killed the president. And that assassin actually used the defense. His doctors were incompetent. He said, "Oh, I didn't kill him, I just shot at him. The doctors killed him." They hanged him anyway. Do they know that our interstate highway system is largely thanks to Dwight Eisenhower, who volunteered to go on a transcontinental army convoy in 1919? 3,200 miles, 6 miles an hour, breakdowns. And then he got to Germany as Supreme Allied Commander, and he saw the Autobahns, and he said, "We've got to do something." And as president, 1956, he pushed for the Interstate Highway Act. Just story after story after story. Show visuals. There are lots of visuals. I tend to be a visual person. Timelines, I think, are incredibly important to history. And this is not something I did the first year I taught. It took me a number of years to get this all pulled together. But I put 2 timelines around the entire classroom. One was world history and the other was American history. I could switch them out depending on which year I was teaching. They provide visual spacing. So I started with Columbus and around to 2020. So that's roughly 500 years. And then you can say, okay, so from here the whole way around is 500 years. When were the Vikings? 500 years before Columbus. That means we would have to take Columbus and go the whole way around the room again to get to the Vikings. Now, what do you think happened in America in that whole 500 years? Shows the vast empty spaces of world history. If creation was back here, in my classroom, Christ was about over there. And the Reformation was about over there. And there was very little information the whole way from creation over to about that wall. It also helps you preserve the chronology in thematic thematic textbooks. For example, you may have a chapter on slavery that is not in chronology. Well, where are these events that deal with slavery coming? Mm-hmm. Well, you can point them out on your timeline. Just a few pictures. It does not have to be anything fancy, but visuals again. There was the start. I integrated my president flashcards into that once you got into, you know, the 1780s, so that they could see the president's terms. So timelines are hugely important. Maps, political maps, topographical maps. I had my whiteboard screen, or I was projecting on my whiteboard here, and my map was here, and some days I didn't have any space to write between them because I needed them both. Maps are hugely important. Posters and displays, and I just brought a couple along that I enjoyed using. Put the Declaration of Independence signing and the Constitution signing side by side. Who wasn't there on the one that was on the other? And of course, I had keys that went with this. This brings Valley Forge to a new light. The Columbian Exchange. Burning of a White House. This last one over here, National Geographic, shows how much of the year the armies in the Civil War actually fought. Well, they didn't fight very much at all. They were sitting in camps, hence the disease, hence everything else. They don't have to even be that fancy. When you go visiting to national historic sites, bring these along back. Oregon Trail. Brings Fort McHenry to life. If you have a magnetic whiteboard, it's a wonderful place to throw that kind of thing up. Cultural drawings, photos, time period dress, very important. Historic processes. You can find pictures, Loringal's Wilder books, even descriptions. Use sketches. I particularly liked vintage photos, political cartoons, paintings, things that I could hold up, show them, or put up on the screen and give them visuals for what we were talking about. And take time to analyze them. And what do you see? Why do you think this? I'll just show you a few. When you study India and the rise of the caste system, this is one that always helped my students. Okay, yeah, you can talk about the caste system. These are lower caste men who dared to fish in an upper caste pond. And the upper caste people threw acid on their faces in punishment. A picture's worth a thousand words. Philip II. Father of Alexander, not Philip II, just Philip of Macedon. Father of Alexander the Great. Lost an eye in battle. What do you think that communicated to his son? And you talk about the enclosure movement. They've never been to Britain and seen hedgerow country. You're going to have to bring it to them. Battle of Little Bighorn. The boys will love this. There's a femur with a tomahawk mark on it. Here's the famed Indian chief Geronimo driving an automobile. the desk and chairs used at the surrender at Appomattox, one of which, the desk I think it was, George Custer carried off as a present for his wife. And you can go on and on and on and on. Just a few up here that I had electronic versions. Does anybody know what that is? That is head smashed in buffalo jump. And that is a verifiable place where the Indians would chase the bison over the cliff to fall to their death. And suddenly they have a mental image of it. Go find pictures of reenactors having a tournament and knights in the Middle Ages come to life. You can see the lance, you can see the armor, and particularly if you can get one of the lance connecting with a shield and shattering. Knights were literally killed in those tournaments. Killed playing. That is the Rubicon. Caesar crossed the Rubicon. It was his Rubicon. We have that expression, people that cross the Rubicon can't go back. Well, it was not a huge river. It was a tiny little rivulet. It was not so much that he couldn't go back, it was that it represented a decision. This is the house where Napoleon spent his exile in St. Helena. He wouldn't go out much, but he was very interested in what the English guards were doing. So he bored little holes in his shutters so that he could spy on his English guards. He was still trying to be emperor at heart. You know the palindrome, able was I ere I saw Elba? Reads the same forward as back. Put that one on the board for your students. This is the cell in Wartburg Castle where Knight George, as he was pantomiming himself to be, actually Martin Luther, had been spirited away, and this is the room in which he translated the New Testament into German. Terracotta warriors. This was an actual terracotta warrior in an exhibit that we toured, and this is what they think they actually looked like, fully painted. Talk about the dispersion, the ziggurats in Sumer. Well, look at all of the copycats of the ziggurat pattern around the world. If you want evidence for the dispersion, show them. This was in China, this was in Mexico, this was. Well, it makes sense. When you study modern art, it's called Picasso and the Bread Rolls. My students always loved that picture of Picasso and the Bread Rolls. This is one of the most poignant pictures that I found of the Depression era that I always like to show my students. The world's highest standard of living, there's no way like the American way, says the billboard, and in front is a bread line. Political cartoons. Uncle Sam choking off the flood of immigrants. Huge visual. The big stick policy. It's one of my favorite ones for Alaska. This is William Seward wanting to float his boats, buying from the Russian, and this political cartoonist literally believed that it was folly. All it is seals and polar bears that tree you on the top of icebergs. And you've just taught Seward's folly and they'll remember it. Do you need to teach anything more about monopolies? There's Standard Oil and its tentacles gobbling up everything. Play audio. Be careful, this isn't just for entertainment. And it should be to teach. It should be educational, not just entertaining. And don't rely on the audio to teach you. I don't feel like teaching history today, so I'm gonna play. I put video with a question mark. I personally think that relying on a lot of video works against trying to teach history and fire the imagination. You have to work within the framework of your culture, But again, I would say don't allow it to, don't try to have it do the teaching for you. I just have three short clips. This is one that my students always loved, not because it was so, well, it is dramatic, but simply because of the old,
starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from immersed in the flames.
Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between us. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. It's smoke and it's flames now, and the frame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity, all the persons speeding around it. I still didn't talk to people that sitting around there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it just laid down massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and baby. Lady,
Hindenburg.
Crash of the Hindenburg. Oh, the humanity. That became a catchword in our classroom. Maybe this is.
In ihrer Lehre unveränderlich, in ihrer Organisation stahlhart, in ihrer Taktik schmiegsam und anpassungsfähig, in ihrem Gesamtbild aber wie ein Orden sein.
Can play with this one.
The surface appears to be very, very fine grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Down there, it's very fine. I'm going to step off the limb. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And then you can tell them the story. It was supposed to be one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. And they were convinced that he didn't say the A, and so they, in this day of technology, they analyzed the tape, took it down, enhanced it, and they determined that he did say it's one small step for a man. It was just microseconds of sound there that our ear can't pick up. Primary sources. One of the benefits of primary sources is that you're not relying on the interpretation of others. You can do a lot of your own interpretation. It also helps put in the historical time context. But keep it brief and interesting. I found that it does not work well to read entire book pages of primary sources. And of course, primary sources don't have to just be text. They can also, some of the photographs are technically primary sources. Keep it brief and interesting. Take your eyes off the page and move around while you're reading. Connect with the audience. When you study the Hippocratic Oath, show them a copy. Give them a copy of the Hippocratic Oath. Don't just rely on them to, oh yeah, Hippocratic Oath. Show them. When you study the church creeds, bring in the creeds and show them how they evolved. This is an excerpt from The Jungle, written by Upton Sinclair. My students always like this one. I'll read just the last paragraph from this excerpt. Worst of any, however, were the fertilizer men and those who served in the cooking rooms. These people could not be shown to a visitor, for the odor of a fertilizer man would scare any ordinary visitor at 100 yards. And as for the other men who worked in tank rooms, full of steam, and in some of which there were open vats near the level of the floor, their peculiar trouble was that they fell into the vats. And when they were fished out, there was never enough of them left to be worth exhibiting. Sometimes they would be overlooked for days, till all but the bones of them had gone out into the world as Durham's pure leaf lard. I got this reputation for reading Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God in context. And students down the hall would claim that they thought I was upset, even though that was ludicrous. But do they realize how Jonathan Edwards would have delivered that sermon? Read it for them. Read it the way you think he would have read it. They'll remember it. Read the Erie Canal song, or better yet, play. Got an old mule and her name is Sal, 15 years on the Erie Canal. There's just loads of that stuff. Read the story of Edmund Ross casting the deciding vote to acquit Andrew Johnson. He said, "I literally looked down into my open grave." Here's a primary source. That's Thomas Edison's to-do list for 1888. And there are things on there that I already know how to pronounce, yet alone solve. You study the Depression and the hobos. Show them hobo nickels. Those are nickels that the hobos would amend, change the face or the back of the coin. If you have any of them, they're worth quite a bit now. Old National Geographics are great for this thing. Go back and get the old, old ones, like 50s, 40s. They are great at paintings of world history events. Now, obviously, I can't hold this up and say this is exactly what Justinian and Theodora looked like. But it's a great visual. And then read what Theodora was saying to Justinian in that picture. "It is impossible for a man once born not to die, but for a man who has reigned as emperor, exile is intolerable. If you wish to save yourself, sire, it can be easily done. We have plenty of money. There is the sea. Here are the ships. But think whether, once you have escaped to a place of safety, you would not prefer death. For my own part, I hold to the old saying that imperial purple makes the best burial sheet." This is one that I found when you study Sears and Roebuck. Can they match the literal items from the old Sears catalog of 1897 with their prices? I love it. Read the letter from a freedman to his old master when the old master wanted him to come back and work for him after the Civil War. And he said, "Well, if you pay me all my back wages for the years I was a slave, I will." I thought they were animals, you know. Got him through that. If these people were subhuman, how does he have that level of intelligence? Tie into local history with your primary sources. Just give you two examples. There was a Governor Snyder mansion 20 minutes from school that was a station on the Underground Railroad and had a tunnel out the back that went down to Penn's Creek. Tell them that kind of thing. Keep your eyes open on those historic signs. Jacob Coxey was born near where I taught. And the only way I know that is because of one of those PA historic markers that was erected. Spin real life examples. Get your students involved. And there are a couple ways to do this. Involve the students. Use their names in examples. I used this, for example, when we study Hammurabi. So Hammurabi said, everybody who commits the same crime should be punished in the same way. Use them in examples. So if Jordan does this, and Andrew does this, and I like Jordan because he just gave me a candy bar, and they'll get this sort of sheepish, "Oh, there's Chuck's and teacher's calling on me again." Look, but they love it, and you won't find those students daydreaming so quickly. Another place I would use it is the forms of government, like the monarchy and the oligarchy and the dictatorship, that cycle of Greek government. So, Tom whispers in all the peasants' ears, and he promises them, and you know your students, he promises them this and this, and they'll connect. Help them understand the Inquisition. You know how students like to, or children like to, trump up stories about each other. Show cause and effect. Connect stories to previous stories. How does it affect us today? Imagine how it was. And this can be a tie into composition class. Write as if you were there. Write a newspaper article that covers the event that we're studying. What do you think their fears were? How were their fears and concerns different than yours? How were they the same as yours? Keep a historical diary, Oregon Trail diary. What do you think happened today on the Oregon Trail? Take them to a forest and say, now how would you develop this forest into, this may be for a little younger students, but if you were a pioneer and I brought you to this clearing, how would you go about changing it? Where would you get your source of heat? Where would you get your water? Where would you get your food? How would this city have looked 100 years ago, 200 years ago? What would you do and why? And you got to be careful with this. I always tried to steer clear of situations that would put them into scenarios where they would weaken their non-resistance or their morality. And you don't want to put them into a situation and say, soldiers barging through the front door, what would you do? Be careful with it. But Oregon Trail, I did this with my students, gave them a list of supplies, how much they weighed, here's your weight limit, what would you take? Or here's the size of the wagon. It's not as big as you think, by the way. How would you fit everything in? Get a big piece of paper, draw it out, and have them try to fit the barrels and trunks in. The Great Depression put them into situations, some families, in the Dust Bowl, if they could not make their ends meet, if they could not lay up enough supplies for the winter, would literally send their children out. Go try to make money and send it home. And some of those families were never reunited. What would you have done? Would you have run a station on the Underground Railroad? Now that's one where you can address moral dilemmas head on. What were some of the things that you could have done, but what were some of the things that you couldn't have done? Do hands-on projects. I had my American history students do projects, write a little report. They profess to hate it, but deep down in, they'll never forget it. He did a little water wheel. This fella explored different types of fencing and how it was put together. Fellow did a live edge wooden bench. So projects can be great. Try to involve everybody and give them examples. Pan for gold, you can buy those kits for a little bit of nothing. One year I had my students put together a little ornithopter kit when we studied Leonardo da Vinci. Had a wind up rubber band and this thing supposedly flapped. It never got off the ground, but they had fun building it. I read one woman that said it's impossible to study Egypt without mummifying a chicken. Now, that's one I've never tried, but you can find the plans online, and the students loved it. Role-playing, be careful with that one. One of the things I would have my students do, and this ties in with maps as well as projects, but I had them color and label their own American history map books. I would give them the sheets throughout the year with instructions on how to do it. And somebody who's hands-on, who learns spatially, can benefit from that. This was one that I started, and this was a sort of an extra thing for some of the people who had extra time. But the American presidents, facts about them, and had them put together a little booklet. I don't know if they'll keep it, but I tried. Flashcards. Historic meals and foods. This was one COVID victim that I mourn. I had done an Oregon Trail theme in my room, and we were planning to have an Oregon Trail meal, cook it over the fire, and then COVID happened. Have them taste hasty pudding. Field trips. Field trips are great for hands-on students. Try the living history museums where they can actually do things. Research projects. You ever tried a time capsule? I never tried that one. It was always on my radar screen. Have them bury a time capsule to be unearthed 20 years in the future. Play historical games. I put some links for some of the food and things on your... have them trade. Have them barter. They don't have a clue how that's done. This was one that I My aunt had given me this game. It's called Mikado. When we studied the Japanese emperor, this was supposedly a game that they played. You try to pull the pieces out without the spring snapping over. And so it's a tie-in. Mikado means nothing to them if you just tell them it's the Japanese emperor. Costumes, be very careful with that one, particularly in the older students. Tools are a great one. The last one I have here is use immersion therapy. What that simply means is, I've said already, okay, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink, but I'm going to stick as much stuff in front of them as I can. Saturate them with it. Something's got to stick. And so that is, there's an inexhaustible supply of interesting stuff. I had a countertop and it was always full of this stuff. I would clip together the pages I didn't want them to see, and they left, they knew the clips were to stay on. And morning before school, they could browse through that stuff. That's a great time to put out things like this National Geographic article on what really happened with the Maine. And there's diagrams of what it would look like if it was a mine exploding inward versus the boilers exploding out. It's a great time for them to read about Izzy and Moe, the Prohibition agents. You don't have time to cover all this stuff in class. Best quotes from Aesop. Do they really realize how much stuff comes from Aesop? Do they realize how much of our English expressions come from Shakespeare? You can't read all that in class, but stick it out there for them. Some of it may. Find at least one interesting detail or picture for each class. You can't do everything, but you can do at least something. Display magazines, books, pictures. And here's one that I found to be tremendously useful. Look for news items, should be news, not new items. Look for news items related to your studies. You will be amazed how many times you're studying ancient Egypt and there'll be something in the news about a new discovery in Egypt. And of course, you have to have access to that, but I'll just give you two examples. This is one that I clipped out of the newspaper back on the 100-year anniversary of World War I. That is a sea of poppies, each poppy representing one of the British dead from World War I. Hang on to it. It impressed them at the time, and it has impressed every group of students since. This was a news article about a fellow that made prosthetic face masks for soldiers that had been injured in World War I. And suddenly the horror of World War I comes home when they look at what some of those, how they were disfigured. This was not a newspaper, but this was just recently, what would George Washington look like today? Somebody cooped up in the pandemic with nothing to do other than to imagine, took a painting of George Washington and modernized it. And students love that kind of stuff. Immersion therapy. I mentioned the Oregon Trail theme. These are just a couple pictures. I did an Oregon Trail theme one year, go or stay. So what would your decision be? Here are the pros, here are the cons. Had a little wagon coming out of the wall. I gave them each an Oregon Trail name, a name of somebody who was on the Oregon Trail, and throughout the year I would update them on how their person was coming along. Some of them didn't make it. And of course they loved that. Posters and things. They loved the longhorns. That's immersion therapy. Just sticking it there, and something's got to stay. This was, what would you take? Here's a list of everything that you could take with its weights. Here's your weight limit. And I had them actually do it as an art craft thing in teams to see what they would come up with. All right, this last part, I'll just go across quickly these resources. Some of them are on your resource sheet that I gave you. Build a library. I think this is incredibly important. I don't know how many books I have, probably more than what I should. But I remember what Melvin Lehman said at Teachers Week a number of years ago. My wife and I didn't have a lot of money, but we decided we'd always have money for two things, good books and good music. And you really don't have to spend that much. Go to used book sales, library sales. The type of books that are on that list, like from Reader's Digest, National Geographic, are books that people gave other people for Christmas, and the other people say, oh, what am I going to do with these big book pictures of ancient Egypt? Nice thought, Aunt Matilda. And they get rid of it. And that's a great resource for somebody like me. Hold up pictures of what the different styles of pyramids were. Amazon, eBay, there's tremendous online resources. Subscribe to history magazines. This is a great one. American History, I've gotten this one for over 20 years. Have 20 years worth of these. National Geographic, go to used bookstores and see if you can get back copies. Got a complete set back to about 1960. From 1888 up to 1960, you can get on CD, DVD-ROM and print them. I'll let this up here, you can take a look at it. This is one that I would highly recommend. National Geographic History. It is by National Geographic with the same quality of pictures and all of that, but it is dedicated primarily to history. That has tremendous resource material. Smithsonian is not quite as good, but it's another good one. Get a national daily newspaper, at least secondhand. I couldn't afford to buy the Washington Post, but I got it secondhand. Who cares that it was 2 months old? An article like those poppies? I didn't have to have that the day it happened, but I've got it now. I don't know if that's a verb or, I know it's a noun, but I made it a verb, pack rat. How many filing cabinets do I have at home? 3 or 4, 4-drawer files, full stuff. But has some efficient filing system. I have my color, my cabinets are color coded. The drawers are A, B, C, D, and the files are numbered. So it's in my database. I do a spreadsheet that I can search. I'm going to put the article in. I put this in as Shipwreck Kelly. So Shipwreck Kelly sat on flagpoles for 45 days at a shot, just simply as part of the excess of the booming 20s. So I would put that in as Shipwreck Kelly, and then I would put keywords in. Roaring 20s, Shipwreck Kelly, flagpole. And then I could search, and then it would tell me this one was B67. Visit historical places and take pictures. The pictures I've taken over the years visiting Colonial Williamsburg come in wonderfully handy when you study colonial government. And when you study the classes. Okay, so here's a picture. Do you think this was upper class, middle class, or lower class? Here's a house. Is this upper class, lower class, middle class? And you're engaging them. And that's where I bought the Valley Forge poster. I got these at the Capitol gift shop, that one at the White House gift shop. This was one that I was going to mention. You have to have a book like this. This is called a Historical Atlas of the United States, and it doesn't have to be a 2021 edition. It can be a 1990 edition that you can get cheap. These things brand new are probably $100. You can get them used. This is Henry Ford's assembly line with a key. And your boys will be over that like flies over a piece of meat at break. Listen to and attend history lectures. Use the internet carefully. And I say carefully, not for the obvious reason of the corruption that's on the internet. There's a lot of uneducated stuff on the internet. Believe me? Just Google 9/11 conspiracy theory. Don't. All right, are there any questions, anything you'd like to discuss? I have more stuff I can show you. But anything that you found, have about 5 minutes here to open it up to you. Make sure when you talk about the Roaring Twenties that you show them the brother and sister duo who danced solid for 3,327 consecutive hours. They would take turns sleeping while the other one dragged them around the floor. And instantly you'll have some math whiz back there figuring out how many days that was. This is an interesting one. When the banks close and you don't have money, this becomes your mode of currency. Write it on a oyster shell. Anybody know what that is? supposedly two Civil War bullets that met head on. They were found on a battlefield. You can see the butt end of the bullet there, and the lead is just melted together. Again, you've got to be a little bit careful on that, but it is a museum. Do they realize what a cannonball does to the human femur? It's the kind of thing you can find with 10 seconds worth of research that this is the remnants, and I actually took a picture of this one, and I just printed this off for convenience. This wasn't the picture I took. This was what was left of a full standing tree after the Battle of Chancellorsville. That was what was left. Do they realize what condition slaves, this was National Geographic printout again, do they realize the condition of slaves? Have they seen the door of no return? The door through which slaves were loaded. The door of no return. George Washington's teeth. He had one of his own left. And these were engineered to fit around them. By the way, he never had a set of wooden ones. That's a myth. One thing that's not a myth is that he apparently was determined that his horses weren't going to end up in the same fix because he hired a team of people to brush his horses' teeth every day. Roundheads versus Cavaliers. When you study the English Civil War. William Taft's bathtub. When he was governor of the Philippines, he wired a friend and went horseback riding this morning. The friend wired back, "How's the horse?" When you study business boom of the early 1900s, this is one that I realized that I could go back in the old National Geographics that are on DVDs. This is Ivory Soap's campaign, ad campaign. This is simply off the back inlet insert of National Geographic. 99.44% pure was their slogan. Very interesting advertising. I don't want it. Anything else? Any questions? Anything that you found to work in your classroom? In just a couple minutes.
13.
No wonder you have all this stuff.
But in all actuality, I probably had a lot of the stuff before I ever taught history, simply because of collecting it. Here's another one. When you go visiting, go to the gift shops not to get the mugs. Go to the gift shop to get the books. This is great. National Park Service. Wonderful diagrams of how locks work. This is one my students love, political cartoons. You might be able to find this one, it's on your list there, you might be able to find this one used. The greatest stories never told. Loads of fun stories that will connect with them. All right, I'll let some of this stuff up here if you want to look at it. Other than that, I hope I've inspired you to be a Hannibal, not in taking a oath to defeat Romans, but in taking a vow to yourself that you will do a little more this year than what you did last year. You will find something extra to do. Can't do everything, but you can do something. So take that vow, and if it doesn't work out, you can always go home and rebuild.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.